Would you turn in your Bibles, please, to the reading we had a few minutes ago, to Revelation, one of the easier books to find right at the end, Revelation chapter 3 and verse 7. I used to feel that the letters in Revelation were about the one place where you stood a chance of understanding what was going on. I think that was probably before I started studying them. There's a lovely principle which seems to run all the way through the book, which goes something like this: things aren't what they seem. These letters give us all sorts of principles, don't they, as they tell the story of the struggles of various groups of Christians. And this is one of them. How easy it is to be so caught up in the thick of it, in the busyness of Christian life, in this case, in the struggle of Christian living, that you get your perspective all wrong. And what a lethal blind spot that can be. I mean, we see trivial examples of it, don't we? I mean, watch Match of the Day. And as they slog it out in some mud patch of a football field, John Motson, from his marvellous vantage point, starts saying how one team should spread it wider and use their wingers or something. It's easy for him to see, isn't it? Or it's cricket in a test match, and Jim Laker's one comment during the whole of the morning's play is that they should bring on the spinners now. It's easy from where he's sitting. But I feel these letters, if I can put it reverently, are, so to speak, God's half-time talk. God's little notes sent out to, in the drinks interval. Because he's got the perspective right. And he longs that his Christian people should see it clearly. Watch what's happening to this church. It's a classic example of the enemy desperately trying to keep us in the wrong perspective. Look at the bluff that's going on, will you? Here's the Christian church at Philadelphia, verse 8. I know your works. I know you have but little power. It's a very small, weak little church. They've got no influence. They're facing persecution. No one will miss it if it disappears. The church at Philadelphia is hardly one of the high spot of the tour of the town for the trippers. You know, the gateway to the east, as Philadelphia was known. They show you the museum and the marketplace and the temple to Dionysius, maybe even the synagogue, but you'd look in vain in your Michelin guide for the Christian church. Philadelphia Times on a Saturday wouldn't even rate it a mention under Divine Services for Sunday. It's not worth it. And the opposition? I imagine all the usual opposition you get in a prosperous pagan city with no interest in the gospel. And you say, just a moment, look, here we are at St. Helens on a Sunday night and there's crowds of us and I can't really count them all. That's hardly the way we feel, is it? It's not really relevant. Well, you're probably right. St. Helens on a Sunday night, there are plenty of the other bluffs to the churches at Ephesus and Sardis and Laodicea that we should be looking at. You can do them for homework. But is this so far out? Is this little group of Christians so far from your experience? What happens Monday to Saturday? What does it feel like then? Tiny Christian Union, do you belong to? Someone gave me a tour of your hospital, showed me all the wards and the theatres, told me the big names on your consultant lists and so on. Will they stop and say, oh, by the way, that's where the CU meets, very important group that. They'd never mention it. You're a lonely Christian Monday to Saturday? Someone was telling me the other Tuesday that they worked in some big firm in the city, the name I'm afraid meant nothing to me, but they said we've got something like 2,000 employees. I've met to three other Christians. They wouldn't be missed, would they, if they disappeared? Or maybe you come from a struggling church that you go to on a Sunday morning. Perhaps surrounded by estates or the like that really have no interest in Christ. Maybe you teach in a school where frankly no one gives God a second thought except as a swear word. You're in that situation. It's easy to start thinking, isn't it? Well, you really don't have a chance. I mean, there's no point. I give up. Watch how you feel when you actually put into practice some of the things we've been hearing earlier and you invite someone to the encounter. Or if you're at London Hospital, you invite them to their mission. If you're like me, you don't feel as you feel now, surrounded with hundreds of other Christians and very secure. When it's just you and your friend or your enemy you're inviting, the odds seem the other way around, don't they? It is only 1-1, but I feel it's 1 against 500, not 500 against 1. I don't know about you, but I feel very weak-kneed when it comes to that. I'm wondering all the time, what's he going to think of me? Do I look a fool? Do I sound a fool? I certainly feel a fool. I know you have but little power. Evangelism has a knack of bringing out our insecurities, doesn't it? It's why so often we avoid doing it. And leave it to the other 499 to fill this place for the encounter. I can remember going on a mission where I was asked to help out at one college, and I was sent a letter from the college about their Christian union, and I was told how strong it was, and there were 20, 30 members, and they were all looking forward to it very much, and the usual stuff. And I arrived there, and I think I met about 3 or 4 of them. And as the week dragged on, and I slowly began to discover other people who, yes, they were Christians, but no, they were terribly sorry, they were very busy this week, I realized the sort of rabbit warren mentality that had taken place even amongst the Christians. Soon as the mission came up and we were actually asked to go outside our little group, it was down the burrows. Only when we got to the end of the week and the sort of all clear was beginning to sound, that heads began to pop up again, and we could go back to joining the CU. I know you have but little power. And the trouble is for this church in Philadelphia is that it wasn't just the usual opposition. When you were in religious circles, they were up against it too. Look at verse 9. There seemed to be there a strong Jewish faction with their fierce resistance to the gospel of Christ. They were an arrogant, a seemingly powerful group who'd taken over all the claims the Christians would have made for themselves. They say that they're Jews. They were claiming they were the ones that were God's people. They were the ones that he loves. Aggressively hostile, they were claiming that only they had access to the door of God's kingdom. You know, it's on their terms you can meet with God. Attempts to restrict this open door of the gospel, they're not new, are they? But they're very common. Whether it's on grounds of race or of ceremonial rites, I dare say they were insisting on circumcision. You tell a lot, don't you, by the questions people ask when the subject of religion comes up. What church do you go? Have you been baptized? If so, how? Have you been through this hoop or that hoop? Whether it's those sort of ceremonies or experiences or groupings, how discouraging to this little bunch of Christians who thought they'd discovered an open door to God. It's a little like, isn't it, you go around driving, trying to find somewhere to park the car, and at last you get out of the meter zone, and you find there aren't double yellow lines on the side of the road, and you see a gap, and you get up to it, and what is there written there? All these sort of homemade no parking signs to sort of keep you off someone's gap. You know, and they try and look official. They can't say police notice, but they write polite notice and hope you don't notice. Someone was telling me the other day of one person's driveway where they'd even gone so far as to paint lines on the road to show that the parking space ended just before and started just after their driveway. It all looked terribly official. Though it carries no authority. But when the nth gap is filled like that, it's easy to start saying, oh, what's the point? I give up. And then the bluffs work. And the enemy's smiling. And Satan's been pulling it ever since. Too many churches and Christians find themselves saying things like that. The bluff, it's what it looks like. You're in a minority. No one's really interested. You're very weak. Even in religious circles, you're just on the fringe. I know you have but little power. So secondly, look at the truth. The truth that Jesus wants to put over to this church, how things really are. And time again in the book of Revelation, you'll find the truth he's trying to put over is, well, the simple one that's summed up in that chorus we often sing, our God reigns. Jesus is Lord. Never looks like it. Well, it doesn't, does it? But that's actually the truth. And it turns everything upside down. Now, bear with me for a few minutes as we look at this introduction in verse 7, because it's the key to it all. Jesus writes as the Holy One. It's a phrase commonly used to signify the Messiah. He's the true one. He's the real reality. He's the one who's faithful to what he promises. He's the one who has the key of David. Oh, Revelation's full of pictures, isn't it? But here, he's referring back to the Old Testament, to a character called Eliakim. He was one, a person in Hezekiah's time, who was made the steward over all the household. And God appointed him as that steward, and he said this of him. He said, I'll place on his shoulder the key of the house of David. He shall open, and none shall shut. He shall shut, and none shall open. Do you see what the picture is? It's of a steward who's been given all authority, isn't it? I'll put on his shoulder the key of David. He shall open, and no one shall shut. This was the man who'd got, yes, all the authority in the king's household. What he said went. You had to go through him. He'd got the key. And Jesus says, when it comes to the kingdom of God, I'm just like that steward. Jesus stands as the one who's over the household of God. Jesus stands as the one to whom all authority has been delegated in heaven and on earth. What an immensely powerful position. He's the keys of the kingdom of God. You want in? You have to go through him. Isn't that what he's reminding them of? And he's able to say, verse 8, behold, I've set before you an open door. What is that door? Well, it must be at least this, in the sense of this letter, it must be, mustn't it, the door of salvation? And isn't this the factor that changes the picture? That it's Jesus who calls the tune. It's Jesus who pulls the shots. It's Jesus who has the master key. And once you've got that clear, and once we understand the statement that he has opened the door, he's set before them this open door. Why, all the objections, all the obstructions that people are piling up, they're worth nothing. Now look, it said, I have set before you an open door. The idea isn't, no, I'll do that. That's just what I'll do for you. It's something in the past. It's something that's been done. It's perfect tense. Isn't he looking back and explaining again what the cross means? There on the cross, Christ set before an open door. Mark has his picture of it, doesn't he, in his gospel, with the curtain in the temple that guarded the Holy of Holies. It's as if all those people there in the choir stalls, we're not allowed to see them. There's a great curtain across. And he says, as Jesus cries out, it's finished, it's done on the cross, the curtain, it's torn in two. The very place where God was supposed to dwell, where no one was meant to see, suddenly everyone could see into it. Now, I have no doubt at the time that the Jews there didn't leave it like that. As soon as the priests saw it and they got over the shock horror, they'd have been down in the basement and up with the stepladders, wouldn't they, and sort of stitching it up again. We can't have anyone looking in there. Isn't that what they're still trying to do here? But Jesus, whatever they might have done with that picture, in reality, they can do nothing about it. I've set before you an open door, and no one's able to shut that. God has reached down, so to speak, and opened the door into his presence. The Jews may be trying for these Christians at Philadelphia to close the door of the kingdom, but they can't succeed, for Christ has the key. And anyway, he says they're not Jews. Well, not in the sense that the New Testament comes to understand them, not true Jews. Those are people who are Jews inwardly, not just by ancestry. They're the ones who are the followers of the Messiah. A valid claim to God's love depends not on who your father was, but what your relationship to Christ is. What an encouragement to these few Christians. And what a commentary, isn't it, on Jesus' ministry. If only they stopped and thought back, they'd see that it had always been this way. A Christ who throws open a door and people endlessly trying to shut it again. Come with me, if you're tiring of Revelation, into Luke's Gospel and just look up two or three brief incidents. Luke chapter 5. Verse 27. After this, Jesus went out and saw a tax collector named Levi sitting at the tax office, and he said to him, "Follow me." And he left everything and rose and followed him. And Levi made him a great feast in his house, and there was a large company of tax collectors and others sitting at table with them. And the Pharisees and their scribes murmured against his disciples, saying, "Why do you eat and drink with tax collectors and sinners?" What's going on? Hasn't Jesus thrown open the door to Levi? And instantly, the Pharisees and the scribes are desperately trying to shut it, but they can't. Turn over towards the end of that gospel, chapter 18. The end of chapter 18, verse 35. Jesus on the road to Jericho. Blind man sitting by the roadside. He hears it's Jesus of Nazareth passing by. Verse 38, he cried, "Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me." And those who were in front rebuked him, telling him to be silent. But he cried out all the more, "Son of David, have mercy on me." And Jesus stops, commands him to be brought to him, asks what he wants. And Jesus, verse 42, said to him, "Receive your sight. Your faith has made you well." What's happening? Those in the crowd are trying to shut him out, and Jesus sets an open door before him. Or the very next chapter. Same thing happens again. Zacchaeus, we'll look at this more closely next week. Look at verse 5, that familiar story. When Jesus came to the place, he looked up and said to him, Zacchaeus, make haste and come down. I'm going to stay at your house today. So Zacchaeus made haste, came down, received him joyfully. And when they saw it, the crowd all murmured, he's gone in to be the guest of a man who's a sinner. Can't have him in there. The door isn't that open. There's nothing new. Behold, I've set before you an open door which no one is able to shut. What an encouragement. And how chilling the reverse side of the coin. If he shuts it, no one shall open it. That frightening story of the wise and the foolish maidens with their oil lamps, you remember it, waiting for the bride to appear, the bridegroom, and they dash off the ones who'd forgotten the oil, and by the time they bought it from the local supermarket and they're back, the doors are shut. There's no way in. And yet we're so quickly deceived into forgetting that it's God's world, that he is the one with the authority, that he's the one who says open and no one shuts, and shut and no one opens. Our pride is endlessly wanting to run the world for him. Have you listened to the way people talk when religion comes on the agenda and folk are explaining their views about what makes you in or not? Listen hard next time. Everyone's got a view. They love to share it. And the picture you get isn't of a God who's delegated his authority to Christ. Now the picture, isn't it, is of us delegating our authority to God. The way I see it is this, you know, God will do this, that and the other. Well, I'd like to think in the end that, you know, God wouldn't say no to people like that. No, of course, I don't see how God could ask more than this. It's amazing, every time God puts wide open the door, we try and erect barriers. And when he shuts it, we seem to expect it to be open. The door of salvation, an open one, which no one is able to shut, he says. But I don't think we can also avoid the implications of this door being a door of service. It's used that way so often in the New Testament. And it's as if Jesus is saying to this bunch of Christians, look, I've set before you an open door of opportunity. Oh, but you don't understand. You say, look, I mean, there's not much of me. And Christ says, yes, I do. I know your works. I know you've little power. I also know who has the key. And you see, that changes everything around. I've set before you an open door that no one is able to shut. You have a door of opportunity. Have you thought what a difference that makes to all our evangelism? If you really grasp this point that it is he who is Lord and it is he who opens the door and no one can shut it, and it's out with the battering ram, isn't it? You know, those sort of tactics where everyone sort of charges up to anyone they can find and tries to sort of ram the gospel down people's throats. As if the only way you're ever going to open a door is if you kick it hard enough. I know now, if this really is our God, if he's the God who opens the door of service, it's me trying every conceivable door. Which is the one that he's got open at the moment? Is that the way you'll act with your friends? Is that the way you'll pray for them? It's a good starting point. Lord, show me the open doors. Come and pray with us next Sunday at 6 o'clock. There's room for a couple more in the basement next week. the end to all my excuses, isn't it? My fear is that really I'm not good enough to do this. You need to be a 10-talent man to cope. Not if God has the key. I remember being taught this lesson by a lad called Peter. Peter is my standing rebuke every time I think that I can't ever do anything for God. He was a chap I met on a house party. He was still at school then. He was a sort of weedy looking guy with specs and a swat. And worse still, he wasn't very bright in spite of the swatting. And he was the sort of chap who wrote to me endless 6-page letters with dozens of questions on them, from, you know, what do I do if I have a headache, to what's the meaning of predestination? And you were meant to sort of sort all of those out between you. Over the years, I slowly realized what was happening. The one thing he didn't hang back on was stepping through the door of opportunity. He asked for a booklet explaining the Christian life and gave it to his mother, who found Christ. He said he invited, but I suspect he ordered his sister to a Christian house party where she found Christ. He won a school friend and stuck with him and saw him established in the faith. He went to teach in a prep school, and there was a lay reader also teaching there. And Peter, I don't know where he got the guts to do it from, but got the lay reader back on Scripture Union Daily Bread notes because he hadn't been reading the Bible for years. The last letter I had from him, he was at college and he told me about a pancake party that he'd invited friends to and a missioner, and they'd found Christ. Peter is struggling to find one talent. But his God is the God who opens doors, and no one shall shut them. The bluff, you've but little power. The truth, I've set before you an open door. And lastly, the challenge. And the challenge comes in verse 11. And it really is a bit of a letdown. I mean, you'd expect in this situation something swashbuckling. But all Jesus says is keep going. Verse 11, I'm coming soon. Hold fast what you have. Hold fast. As you look at this letter, you discover that's the mark that Jesus is looking for in the Christian. The mark of the Christian is faithfulness, isn't it? It's what they're praised for. At least a couple of times here. Verse 8. I know you have but little power, and yet you've kept my word and have not denied my name. Yes, I know that you're rather feeble, that you've been put under a lot of pressure, but you've stuck to my word and you've not denied my name. Do you notice those two go together? We're endlessly being encouraged to believe in a Jesus as long as we separate him from his words. It's a very barren encouragement. There's no moral or spiritual power in a Jesus without his words. There's still in a Jesus with our words attached. Or again, verse 10. Because you've kept my word of patient endurance. The commentators who know about these things say that actually is probably you've kept the word of my patient endurance. You've kept the teaching exemplified by Christ's steadfastness, by Christ's perseverance. Very easy to forget that quality that Christ had, isn't it? Quite a test there of a Christian. Not what we start, or even who starts anything, but who's there when the going gets tough? Who's there at the end? Who lasts? I remember a Christian missionary telling me of the situation they were in, which was a pretty rough one, and how their center got vandalized very early, and all sorts of attacks were made on them. And it was about 12 months later that the local people around finally came to them and said, we want to support you now. And they said, well, what about all that's been going on? And they said, we wanted to see if you were genuine. Everyone else who came to help left within 6 months. So he says, verse 11, hold fast what you have, so you don't lose what's to come, so that no one may seize your crown. That's not for the now, that's for the not yet. Isn't that fair? Be faithful. Keep at it. Look, it was made very clear to me as I contrasted the church in Philadelphia with the church at Smyrna. That's back in chapter 2, verses 8 following. Just look at the pattern, will you? Here are these churches. They're both facing fierce opposition. Jews who are not. Verse 9 of both chapters. Synagogues of Satan. That's strong language, isn't it? Look what's promised to both of them. In verses 10 of the respective chapters, to the church in Smyrna they're told, be faithful unto death. A martyr's death is awaiting many of them. Verse 10, here, not death but deliverance, I will keep you either from or in the hour of trial which is coming. And look what's promised to both of them, a crown, the crown of life to Smyrna, the crown that no one else may seize, verse 11 to here in Philadelphia. Now, do you understand that? The key test for the disciple, therefore, is not whether it's going to be deliverance or death. It may be either. That doesn't test my whether I'm a disciple or not. The key test for me is, will I be faithful? The key test for God is not, similarly, whether he'll deliver us or whether he'll see us die a martyr's death. He doesn't promise to deliver us. No, the key test for God's faithfulness is that he will keep his promise, whether via a martyr's death or not, to give the crown of life. Hold fast. The mark of the Christian. Hold fast because you've got the security of a Christian all waiting for you. God is the great encourager, isn't he? He's not oblivious to their fears and their worries. Here are these poor Christians. They never thought that anyone noticed them even. They weren't on the map in Philadelphia. They never dreamt of being on the map of heaven, let alone on the postal round. And God says, you're not just a pin on the map, but you'll be a pillar of the place. Verse 12. This superb promise of security for them. I'll make him a pillar in the temple of my God. Never shall he go out of it. I'll write on him the name of my God, the name of the city of my God. You'll belong to God, to God's city, to God's Son. You'll be a pillar of the establishment. You really can't ask for more security than that, can you? To a city destroyed virtually by an earthquake a few years previously. What a picture to give them, to be a pillar, immovable. To Christians longing for permanence and stability and assurance. What a prospect. So hold fast. It's all yours. And all of it, of course, all of it, Jesus is saying, belongs the far side of that open door. It's in the not yet. And now Jesus faces his church with an open door that no one can shut. A door of salvation. Yes, it's been flung wide open into the presence of God, and no one can slam it in your face or say, sorry, this entrance is not for you. And those who aren't Christians still shrink from it. It means turning off the well-trod path. You stepped through it yet? Or the open door of service. And everything inside you shrinks from going through it. All your instincts for self-preservation say, as long as I stay this side, I'm safe. No one's going to mind as long as I keep my head down. And Jesus says, in spite of the fact that it seems completely the opposite, security actually lies as you step through that open door into the unknown, on to becoming a pillar. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches.